The gates of Adamant's estate swung shut behind Hawk and Fisher. The house at the end of the gravel pathway on which they walked was a traditional two-story mansion with gable windows and a front porch large enough to shelter a small army. Anywhere else in the steppes, a place like this would have had a whole family living in each room. Ivy sprawled across most of the front wall, its thickness suggesting that it alone was holding the aged brickwork together. There were four squat chimney pots at one end of the roof, all of them smoking. Hawk looked unhappily around him as he and Fisher made their way through the grounds toward the house. The wide grass lawns were faded and withered, and there were no flowers. The air smelled rank and oppressive. The single tree was dark and twisted, its branches bare. It looked as though it had been poisoned and then struck by lightning.
This is a dump. Are you sure this is the right place?
Unfortunately, yes. Looks like nothing's grown here for years. Still, not everyone likes gardening.
They walked the rest of the way in silence. Hawk strained his ears for some sound apart from their own boots on the gravel drive, but the grounds were unnaturally quiet. By the time they got to the massive front door, Hawk had managed to thoroughly unsettle himself. At the very least, there should have been the bustling sounds of the heavy crowds outside, the everyday clamor of a city at work and at play. Instead, Adamant's house and grounds stood stark and still in their own little pool of silence. There was a large and blocky brass knocker on the door, shaped like a lion's head with a brass ring in its jaws. Hawk quickly let go of the brass ring.
I feel like that lion head is looking at me.
Yeah, I feel it too. This place gives me the creeps, Hawk.
Yeah, we've seen worse. Anyway, you can't judge a man by where he happens to be living, even if he has got a graveyard for a garden.
They fell silent as the massive door swung open on its counterweights. The man standing in the doorway was tall, broad-shouldered, and dressed immaculately in the slightly out-of-date formal wear that identified him immediately as a butler. He looked to be in his early 50s, with a supercilious expression, a bald head, and ridiculous tufts of white hair above his ears. He held himself very correctly. He bowed very politely to Hawk and, after a moment's hesitation, to Fisher.
Good morning, sir. Madam, I am Villiers. If you'll follow me, the master is expecting you.
He stepped back a careful two paces and then stood at attention while Hawk and Fisher entered. As he closed the door, Hawk and Fisher seized the opportunity for a quick look around the hall. It was comfortably spacious, without seeming overbearing, and the wood-paneled walls glowed warmly in the lamplight. Hawk approved of the lamps. Too many halls were oversized and underlit, as though there was something fashionable about eye strain. He realized Villiers was standing politely at his side and turned unhurriedly to face him.
Villiers, you're standing on my shadow. I don't normally like people that close to me.
I'm sorry, sir. I was just wondering if you and your partner would care to remove your cloaks. It is customary.
Yeah, I don't think so. Maybe later.
Villiers bowed slightly, his impassive face somehow managing to convey that, of course, they knew best, even when they were wrong. He led the way down the hall, without looking to see if they were following, and ushered them into a large, comfortably appointed library. All four walls were lined with bookshelves, and leather-bound bookspines gleamed dully from every direction. There was one comfortable chair by the fireplace, which Fisher immediately appropriated, stretching her legs out before her.
If you would be so kind as to wait here, I will inform Master Adamant of your arrival.
He bowed again, to just the right degree, and left the library.
I never did like butlers. They're always such terrible snobs. Worse than their employers, usually.
She looked at the empty fireplace.
Is it just me? Or is it freezing cold in here?
It probably just feels that way, coming in from the warmth outside. These big places hold the cold.
Fisher nodded, looking absently around her.
Do you suppose he's really read all these books?
No. He probably bought them by the yard. Having your own library is quite fashionable at the moment.
Why?
Don't ask me. I've never understood fashion.
Fisher looked at him. There had been something in his voice.
This isn't what you expected, is it?
No, it isn't. James Adamant is supposed to be a man of the people, representing the poor and the downtrodden. This kind of lifestyle is the very thing he's always campaigned against. A big house, a butler, books he's never read. Damn it, he can't even be bothered to look after the place properly.
Don't blame me. I didn't choose this monstrosity.
Hawk turned around quickly, and Fisher rose elegantly to her feet as James Adamant entered the library, followed by Danielle and Medley.
I'm sorry to have kept you waiting. Captains Hawk and Fisher, may I present my wife, Danielle, and my advisor, Stefan Medley.
There was a quick flurry of bows and handshakes. Danielle extended a hand for Hawk to kiss. He shot a quick glance at Fisher and shook the hand instead.
I think we'd all be much more comfortable in my study. This way.
He led them back down the hall and ushered them into the study.
My superiors insisted we take on this draft-ridden folly as Reform headquarters, and in a moment of weakness, I agreed. It's quite unsuitable, of course, but the current thinking is that we have to put on as good a show as the Conservatives, or the voters won't take us seriously. Personally, I think it's that kind of half-baked nonsense that's undermined Reform's credibility with the electorate these past few years. But since I'm only a very junior candidate, I don't get much say in these matters.
Medley brought in some more chairs, and Danielle bustled around, making sure that everyone was comfortably seated and had a brimming glass of wine in their hand. Hawk turned to Danielle.
How do you feel about this place?
It's a ghastly old heap. Smells of damp, and half the time the toilets don't work properly.
Your garden's not up to much either.
Hawk winced. Danielle and Adam had shared a look, their faces suddenly grim.
We have enemies, Captain Fisher. Enemies not averse to using sorcery when they can get away with it. 3 days ago, we had a splendid garden. Fine lawns, well-tended flower beds, and a magnificent old apple tree. Now it's all gone. Nothing will grow there. It's not even safe to walk far from the path. There are things moving in the dead earth. I think they come out at night sometimes. No one's ever seen them, but come the morning, there are scratches on the door and the shutters that weren't there the night before.
There was a cold silence for a moment.
It's illegal for political candidates to use sorcery in any form, directly or indirectly. If you can prove Hardcastle was responsible...
There's no proof. He's too clever for that.
There was another silence.
You made good time in getting here. I only put in my request for you this morning.
Hawk looked at him.
You asked for us specifically?
Well, yes. James has many enemies. I wanted the best people I could get as his bodyguards. You and your partner have an excellent reputation, Captain Hawk.
That isn't always enough. The last time we got involved with guarding a politician, the man died.
We know about Counselor Blackstone. It wasn't your fault he died. You'd done everything you reasonably could to protect him, and you found his murderer long after any other guards would have given up.
Hawk looked at Adamant.
Are you happy with this arrangement, Sir Adamant? It's not too late for you to find somebody else.
I trust my advisor. When it comes to picking the right people for a job, his judgment is impeccable. Stefan knows about such things. Now then, if you and your partner are going to be spending some time with us, I'd better bring you up to date on what's happening in the election. What kind of things do you need to know, Captain Hawk?
Everything. Who your enemies are, what kind of opposition you'll be facing, anything that might give us an edge.
Danielle got to her feet.
If you're going to get all technical, I think I'll go and see how dinner's coming along.
Now, Danny, you promised you wouldn't bother the cook anymore. You know, she hates people looking over her shoulder.
For what we're paying her, she can put up with a little criticism.
Danielle smiled graciously at Hawk and Fisher and left the room. Adamant leaned comfortably back in his chair.
Now then, when you get right down to it, there are only two main parties, Conservative and Reform. But there's also a handful of fringe parties and a few well-supported independents, just to complicate things. There's Free Trade, the Brotherhood of Steel, No Tax on Liquor, also known as the Who's for a Party Party, and various pressure groups, such as the trade guilds and some of the better organized militant religions.
The Conservatives are the main threat. They've got the most money. Free Trade is mainly a merchants' party. They make a lot of speeches, but they're short on popular support. Mostly they end up throwing their weight behind the Conservatives. No Tax on Liquor is Lord Sinclair's personal party. He funds it and runs it practically single-handed. There are always people willing to go along with him, if only for the free booze he dishes out. He's harmless, apart from this one bee in his bonnet. The trade guilds mean well, but they're too disorganized to mount any real threat to the Conservatives, and they know it. Usually they end up working hand in hand with Reform. That's where a lot of our funding comes from.
What about the Brotherhood of Steel? I always thought they were more mystical than political.
The two are pretty much the same in Haven. Power and religion have always gone hand in hand here. Luckily, most of the beings on the Street of Gods are more interested in feuding with each other than getting involved in the day-to-day politics of running Haven. The beings have always been great ones for feuds, but over the past few years, the Brotherhood of Steel has changed its ways. They're nowhere near as insular as they used to be. They're much better organized, and just lately, a militant branch has started flexing its political muscle. They've even got a candidate standing in this election. He won't win, they're not that strong yet. But they could be a deciding factor in who does win.
Who would they be most likely to side with?
Good question. I can think of any number of political fixers who'd pay good money for the answer. I don't know, Captain Hawk. Ordinarily, I'd have said the Conservatives, but the Brotherhood's mystical bent confuses the hell out of me. I don't trust fanatics. There's no telling which way they'll jump when the pressure's on.
All right, now that we're clear on that...
Speak for yourself.
Perhaps you could explain exactly what's at stake in this election. A lot of people have been saying reform could end up dominating the council, even if the Conservatives still hold most of the seats. I don't get that.
It's really very simple.
Hawk's heart sank. Whenever people said that, it always meant that things were about to become very, very complicated. Adamant steepled his fingers and studied them thoughtfully.
There are 21 seats on the council, representing the various districts of Haven. After the last election, Reform held 4 seats, the Conservatives held 11, and there were 6 unaffiliated seats. In practice, the Conservatives ran the council to suit themselves. But this time, there are at least 3 seats that could go either way. All Reform has to do is win 1 extra seat, and, together with the 6 independents, we could take control of the council away from the Conservatives. Which is why this particular election is all set for some of the dirtiest and most vicious political infighting Haven has ever seen.
Oh boy, another excuse to go crazy. Riot in the streets and set fire to things. How long is this madness going to go on for?
Not long. After the result has been announced this evening, there will be general fighting and dancing in the streets, followed by the traditional fireworks display and the paying off of old scores by the victorious party. After that, Haven will go deathly quiet as everyone disappears to bind their wounds, get some sleep, and nurse their hangovers. Not necessarily in that order. Everything clear now?
Almost. What are we doing here?
Adamant looked at Medley and then back at Hawk.
I understood you've been told. You and your partner are here to act as my bodyguards until the election is over.
You don't need us for that. You've got armed men at your gates and probably quite a few more scattered around the house. And if you'd still felt the need for a professional bodyguard, there are any number of agencies in Haven that could have provided you with one. You asked for us specifically, despite our record. Why us, Adamant? What can we do for you that your own men can't?
Adamant leaned back in his chair, and some of his strength seemed to go out of him for a moment, only to return again as he lifted his eyes and met Hawk's gaze squarely.
2 main reasons, Captain Hawk. Firstly, there have been death threats made against me and my wife. Quite nasty threats. Normally, I wouldn't worry too much. Elections always bring out the cranks. But I have reason to believe that these threats may be genuine. There have been 3 separate attempts on my life already, all of them quite professional. Stefan tells me there are whispers that the attacks were sanctioned by Councillor Hardcastle himself. Secondly, it seems I have a traitor among my people. Someone has been leaking information, important information, about my comings and goings and my security arrangements. That person has also been embezzling money from my campaign funds. According to Stefan's investigations, it's been going on for some months. Small amounts at first, but growing larger all the time. What evidence we have been able to piece together suggests that the traitor has to be someone fairly close to me. My friends, my servants, my fellow campaign workers. Someone I trusted has betrayed me. I want you two to act as my bodyguard and identify the traitor.
Hawk and Fisher surged to their feet, reaching for their weapons.
Danny!
Adamant jumped up from his chair and ran for the door. Hawk got there first and yanked the door open. Out in the hall, it was raining blood. Thick crimson gobbets materialized near the ceiling and poured down with unrelenting ferocity. The walls ran with blood. The rugs were already soaked. The stench was sickening.
Danny!
Danielle had been caught halfway up the stairs. She was drenched in blood. Her dress was ruined, and thick rivulets of gore ran out of her matted hair and down her face. She ran down the stairs to Adamant, and he held her in his arms, glaring about him through the pouring blood. Hawk and Fisher stood back to back in the middle of the hall, weapons at the ready, but there was only the blood streaming down around them, thick and heavy. Medley flailed about him, as though trying to swap the falling drops of blood like flies.
Get your wife out of here. This is sorcerer's work.
Adamant started to hurry Danielle toward the front door and then stopped short as a dark shape began to materialize between them and the door. The falling blood ran together, drop joining with drop, to form the beginnings of a body. In the space of a few moments, it grew arms and legs, and grew into a hunched, misshapen figure, something like a man, but the proportions were all wrong. It had huge teeth and claws, and swirling dark clots of blood where its eyes should have been. It moved slowly toward its prey, its body heaving and swelling with every movement. Hawk stepped forward and cut it with his axe. The heavy steel blade sliced through the creature's neck and out again without slowing, sending a wave of blood splashing against the wall. The creature stood its ground unaffected. It was only blood, nothing more. Its substance ran away onto the floor, but blood continued falling from the ceiling to replenish it. Hawk and Fisher both cut at the figure, and it laughed silently at them. It lashed out at Hawk with a dripping arm. Hawk braced himself and met the blow with his axe. Even so, the impact sent him staggering backwards. The creature had weight and substance when it chose to. It started toward Hawk, ignoring Fisher's attempts to draw its attention to it. It struck at Hawk again, and he ducked under the blow at the last moment. Its claws dug ragged furrows in the wall paneling. Hawk scuttled away.
Damn, magic bastard.
The creature turned to follow Hawk.
Right. We're no match for this kind of magic. Adamant, get your people together and then herd them out the back door. We'll try and buy you some time. Most sendings can't travel far from where they materialize. Maybe we can outrun the thing.
Adamant nodded quickly and urged his wife down the hall away from the creature. The rain of blood suddenly increased. Through the crimson haze, Hawk could just make out a second shape beginning to form between them and the other exit. Hawk wiped blood from his face and took a firmer grip on his axe.
Behind you, Hawk!
Hawk just started to turn when the first blood creature swept over him like a wave and all the world went red as the creature enveloped him. He staggered back a pace, scrabbling frantically at the blood that covered his face, cutting off his air. Fisher was quickly at his side, trying to wipe the blood away from his nose and mouth, but it resisted her efforts and clung to his face like taffy. Hawk fell forward onto his hands and knees, shaking his head frantically as his lungs screamed for air. He caught a glimpse of Adamant hovering before him and gestured weakly for him to make a run for the front door while he had the chance. Adamant hesitated, then lifting his head, he raised his voice in a shout.
Mortis! Help us!
A blast of freezing air suddenly swept through the hall, a bitter, icy wind that froze the falling blood into shimmering scarlet crystals. The creature enveloping Hawk cracked apart around him and fell away in hundreds of crimson slivers. Hawk stayed hunched on his knees for a moment, gratefully drawing the icy air into his lungs, then rose slowly to his feet and looked around him. The bloody rain had stopped, and the hall was covered in a sheen of crimson ice. Fisher stood nearby, beating scarlet ice from her cloak. Adamant, Medley, and Danielle looked shocked, but otherwise unhurt. Beyond them stood the second blood creature, caught half-formed by the icy wind. It stood, crouching and incomplete, like an insane sculpture carved from blood-stained ice. Hawk walked over to it and hit it once with his axe. It fell apart and littered the hall floor with jagged shards of crimson ice. Hawk kicked a few of them around, just to be sure, and then turned to face Adamant.
All right, Sir Adamant. I think there are a few questions that need answering. Like, what was all that about, and who or what is Mortis?
Yes. I was hoping you wouldn't have to know about him, but I think you had better meet him.
May I suggest we get out of these clothes first? I'm soaked and half frozen, and this dress is ruined.
She has a point. I look like I've been skinny dipping in a slaughterhouse.
I'm sure we can find you and your partner some fresh clothes. Come with me, Captain Fisher, and I'll see what I can dig out for you. James, you look after Captain Hawk.
Fisher and Danielle disappeared up the stairs together. Hawk looked at Adamant.
All right, first a change of clothes, but then I want to meet Mortis. No more delays, is that clear?
Of course, Captain. But do try and make allowances for Mortis's temper. He's been dead for some 5 months now, and it hasn't done a thing for his disposition.
Hawk walked up to the full-length mirror and studied himself for some time. It didn't help. He still looked like a poor relation, down on his luck. He and Adamant were roughly the same height, but Adamant carried a much larger frame. As a result, the clothes Adamant lent Hawk hung around him as if he'd shrunk in the wash overnight. It wasn't even a particularly fetching outfit. Gray tights, salmon pink knickerbockers, and a frilly white shirt. Whatever the current fashion was, Hawk was pretty damn sure this wasn't it. The frilly shirt in particular worried him. The last time he saw a shirt this frilly, a barmaid's cleavage was spilling out of it. And no matter what Adamant said, he was damned if he was going to wear that silly three-cornered hat. He looked at himself in the mirror one last time. He'd worn worse in his time. At least he still had his guardsman's cloak. Hawk picked up the cloak off the bed and put it on, pulling the heavy cloak around him so that it hid the clothing beneath. Fortunately, all guards' cloaks came with a built-in spell that kept them clean and immaculate no matter what indignities they were subjected to. It was part of the guard's image, and along with the occasional healing spell, was one of the few good perks of the job. Hawk ought really to be rejoining the others, but it wouldn't do them any harm to wait a while. He had several things he wanted to think through while he had the chance. He looked around Adamant's spare bedchamber. It was clean, tidy, and very comfortably appointed. The bed itself was a huge four-poster with hanging curtains, very elegant and expensive. What was a champion of reform doing, living like a king? All right, no one expected him to live like a pauper just to make a point, but this ostentatious display of wealth worried Hawk. According to Adamant, the house had been provided by reform higher-ups. So where were they getting the money? Who funded the reform cause? The trade guilds, obviously, and donations from the faithful. Wealthy patrons like Adamant. But that wouldn't be enough to pay for houses like this. Hawk frowned. This wasn't really any of his business. He was just here to protect Adamant from harm. Not that he was doing such a great job so far. The blood creatures caught him off guard. If Mortis hadn't saved their hides with his sorcery, the election would have been over before it began. More mysteries. Mortis had to be a sorcerer of some kind, and Adamant had to know that associating with a sorcerer was grounds for disqualification. So why was he willing to let Hawk and Fisher meet him? And what was that crack about him being dead for 5 months? What was he, a ghost? Hawk had only been on the case an hour, and already he had more questions than he could shake a stick at. This was going to be just like the Blackstone case all over again, he could tell. He settled his axe comfortably on his right hip and made his way out onto the landing and down the stairs. The hall was sparkling clean, with no trace of blood or ice. Mortis again, presumably. Fisher was waiting for him at the foot of the stairs, wrapped in her guard's cloak. One look at the thunderclouds in her face was enough to tell Hawk that she'd been no luckier in her choice of new clothes than he. He went down to join her and looked ostentatiously around to make sure they were alone.
I'll show you mine if you'll show me yours.
You first.
Hawk opened his cloak with a flourish and stood posed in the traditional flasher's stance. Fisher shook her head.
Hawk, you look like a charcoal street ponce, but it's still not as bad as mine.
Apparently, they hadn't been able to find any of Danielle's clothing that would fit Fisher, and had compromised by lending her men's clothing. Very old and very battered men's clothing. The shirt and trousers probably started out white, but had degenerated over the years into an uneven gray. The cuffs were frayed, there were patches of different colors on the elbows and knees, and there were several important buttons missing.
Apparently, they originally belonged to the gardener. We can't go out looking like this. Hawk, people will laugh themselves to death.
Then we'll just have to keep our cloaks shut and save what's underneath as a weapon of last resort.
Medley poked his head out of the study door.
Ah, Captain Hawk. I thought I heard voices. Everything all right?
Fine. Just fine.
Medley stepped out into the corridor, followed by Adamant and Danielle. They were all in fresh clothes and looked very smart.
If you're quite ready, could we please get a move on? Mortis knows we're coming, and he hates to be kept waiting. The last time he got impatient, he called down a plague of frogs. It took us hours to get those nasty little creatures out of the house.
If he's your friend, your enemies must really be something.
They are. If you'd care to follow me.
He led them down the hall and through a series of corridors that opened eventually onto a simple stone-walled laundry room. There were tables and towels and a freshly scrubbed stone floor. Hawk looked expectantly around him and wondered if he was supposed to make a comment of some sort. As he hesitated, Medley moved over to the middle of the floor and bent down. He took hold of a large steel ring set into the floor. For the first time, Hawk spotted the outlines of a trapdoor. Fisher looked at Adamant.
You keep your sorcerer in the cellar?
He chose it. He finds the dark a comfort.
Hawk looked at Adamant.
You said Mortis was dead. Perhaps you'd care to explain that?
Adamant gestured for Medley to move away from the trapdoor, and he did. Adamant frowned unhappily.
Mortis is my oldest friend. We faced many troubles together. I trust him implicitly. He's a first-class sorcerer, one of the most powerful in the city. He died just over 5 months ago. I even went to his funeral.
But if he's dead, what have you got in your cellar?
A lich. A dead body animated by a sorcerer's will. We don't exactly know what happened, but Mortis was defending us from sorcerous attacks when something went wrong. Terribly wrong. The spell killed him, but somehow Mortis managed to trap his spirit within his dead body. In a sense, he's both living and dead now. Unfortunately, his body is slowly decaying, despite everything he can do to prevent it. The pain and rot of corruption are always with him. It makes him rather short-tempered.
He's haunting his own body, trapped in a prison of decaying flesh, because he wouldn't leave me unprotected.
His name was Mask, but he calls himself Mortis these days. Igor Mortis. It's a joke, sort of.
Hawk and Fisher looked at each other.
All right, let's go meet the corpse.
I can see you and he are going to get on like a house on fire.
He reached down and took a firm hold of the steel ring set into the trapdoor. He braced himself and pulled steadily. As the trapdoor swung open, a rush of freezing air billowed out into the laundry room. Goose flesh rose on Hawk's arms. Adamant lit a lamp and then started down the narrow wooden stairway that led into the darkness of the cellar. Danielle lifted her dress up around her knees and followed him down. Hawk and Fisher looked at each other. Hawk shrugged uneasily and followed Danielle, his hand resting on the axe at his side. Fisher followed him, and Medley brought up the rear, closing the trap door behind him. It was dark and bitterly cold in the cellar. Hawk wrapped his cloak tightly around him, his breathing steaming on the still air. The stairs seemed to go a long way down before they finally came to an end. Adamant's lamp revealed a large square box of a room, packed from wall to bare wall with great slabs of ice. A layer of glistening frost covered everything, and a faint pearly haze softened the lamplight. In the middle of the room, in a small space surrounded by ice, sat a small mummified form wrapped in a white cloak, slumped and motionless on a bare wooden chair. There was no way of approaching it, so Hawk studied the still figure as best he could from a distance. The flesh had sunk clean down to the bone, so that the face was little more than a leathery mask, and the bare hands little more than bony claws. The eyes were sunken pits with tightly closed eyelids. The rest of the body was hidden behind the cloak, for which Hawk was grateful.
I take it the ice is here to preserve the body?
It slows the process, but that's all.
Fisher's mouth twisted in a grimace.
Seems to me it'd be kinder just to let the poor bastard go.
You don't understand. He can't die. Because of what he did, his spirit is tied to his body for as long as it exists. No matter what condition the body is in, or how little remains of it.
He did it for me. Because I needed him.
Danielle put a comforting hand on his arm.
You sure he's still in there? Can he hear us?
The mummified body stirred on its chair. The sunken eyelids crawled open, revealing eyes yellow as urine.
I may be dead, Captain Hawk, but I'm not deaf.
The dead sorcerer's eyes fixed on Hawk and Fisher, and his sunken mouth moved in something that might have been meant as a smile.
Hawk and Fisher, the only honest guards in Haven. I've heard a lot about you.
Nothing good, I hope.
James, I think you'll find you're in excellent hands with these two. They have a formidable reputation.
Apart from the Blackstone affair.
Everyone has their off days. You can trust us to keep you from harm, Sir Adamant. Anyone who wants to get to you has to get past us first.
And there's damn few who have ever done that.
You weren't doing so well against the blood creatures. If Mortis hadn't intervened, we'd have all been killed.
Hush, Danny. Any man can be brought down by sorcery. That's why we have Mortis, to take care of things like that. Is there anything you need while we're here, Mortis? You know, we can't stand this cold for long.
I don't need anything anymore, James. But you need to take more care. It would appear Counselor Hardcastle is more worried about your chances in the election than he's willing to admit in public. He's hired a first-class sorcerer and turned him loose on you. The blood creature was just one of a dozen sendings he's called up out of the darkness. I managed to keep out the others, but there is a limit to what my wards can do. I don't recognize my adversary's style, but he's good. Very good. If I were alive, I might even be worried about him.
Hardcastle must know he's forbidden to use sorcery during an election.
So are we, for that matter.
Well, that's different.
Danielle quickly darted a glance at Hawk and Fisher.
Mortis just uses his magic to protect us.
The Council isn't interested in that kind of distinction. Technically, my very presence in your house is illegal. Not that I ever let technicalities get in my way, but the Council's always been edgy about magic users. Right, Captain Hawk?
Right. That's what comes of living so near the Street of Gods.
Tough. All the candidates have some kind of sorcery backing them up. If they didn't, they wouldn't stand a chance. Magic is like bribery and corruption. Everyone knows about it and everyone turns a blind eye. I don't know why I should sound so disgusted about it. This is Haven, after all.
Being dead doesn't seem to have dulled your faculties at all.
Mortis's mouth twitched.
I find being dead unclutters the mind wonderfully.
Where do you stand when it comes to sorcery, Captain Hawk? Are you going to turn us in and get James disqualified from the election?
My orders are to keep James Adamant alive. As far as I'm concerned, that has overall priority. I'll put up with anything that'll make my job easier.
Well, if that's settled, we really should be going. We've a lot to do and not much time to do it in.
Do you really have to go, James? Can't you stay and talk for a while?
I'm sorry. Everything's piling up right now. I'll come down and see you again as soon as I can. And I'll keep searching for someone who can help you with your condition, no matter how long it takes. There must be someone somewhere.
Yes, I'm sure there is. Don't worry about Hardcastle's sorcerer, James. He may have caught me by surprise once, but I'm ready for him now. Nothing can harm you as long as I am here. I promise you that, my friend.
His eyes slowly closed, and once again, to all appearances, he became nothing more than a mummified corpse without any trace of life. Danielle shivered quickly and tugged at Adamant's arm.
Let's get out of here, James. I'm not dressed for this kind of weather.
Of course, my dear.
He nodded to Medley, who led the way out of the cellar and back into the laundry room. After the bitter cold of the cellar, the pleasant autumn day seemed uncomfortably warm. There was frost in their hair and eyebrows, and they all mopped at their faces as it began to melt. Adamant let the trapdoor fall shut and blew out his lamp. Hawk looked at him.
Is that it? Aren't you going to bolt it or something? If Hardcastle is as ruthless and determined as you made him out to be, what's to stop him from sending assassins here to destroy Mortis's body?
Anyone stupid enough to go down there wouldn't be coming back out again. Mortis's temper wasn't very good when he was alive, and since he's died, he's developed a very nasty sense of humor.
Adamant's study seemed reassuringly normal after the freezing cold and darkness of Mortis's cellar. Hawk picked out the most comfortable-looking chair, turned it so he wouldn't have to sit with his back to the door, and sank down into it. Adamant started to say something and then thought better of it. He gestured for the others to take a seat and busied himself with the wine decanters. Danielle made as though to sit next to Hawk and then quickly chose another chair when Fisher glared at her. Medley sat down beside Danielle, who ignored him. Hawk leaned back in his chair and stretched out his legs. First rule of the guard, if you get the chance to sit down, take it. Guards spend a lot of their time on their feet and it tends to color their thinking. The last of the cellar chill began to seep out of Hawk's bones. Adamant poured him a drink from one of the more expensive-looking decanters. It seemed a good vintage, though Fisher always insisted he had no palate for such things, just as well on a guard's wages. Hawk put down his glass and waited patiently for Adamant to finish pouring wine for the others. There were things that needed to be said.
Sir Adamant, just how reliable is Mortis?
Adamant finished putting the decanter away before answering.
Before he died, very. Now, I don't know. After everything he's been through, it's a wonder he's still coherent, never mind sane. The experience would have broken a lesser man. It still might. As it is, his life now consists mainly of pain and despair. He has no hope and no future, and he knows it. His friendship with me is his last link with normalcy.
What about his magic? Is he still as powerful as he used to be?
He seems to be.
Adamant emptied his glass and poured himself another drink. His hand was perfectly steady.
In his day, Mortis was a very powerful sorcerer. He says he's as strong now as he ever was, but there's no denying his mind does tend to wander on occasion. No doubt that's how those blood creatures got in. If he ever cracks and gives in to all that pain and madness, I think we could all be in very great trouble.
You must realize this changes things. I can't overlook something like this. Mortis could end up as a threat to the whole city.
Yes, he could. That's why I'm telling you all this. I didn't have to. Originally, I'd hoped you wouldn't have to know about him at all. That's why he took so long to deal with those blood creatures. I'd instructed him not to give away his presence unless he absolutely had to. It wasn't until I met him just now and saw him through your eyes that I realized how much he's changed since his death. He used to be such a powerful man.
But as things stand, we're in no danger. You saw for yourself how calm and rational he is. Look, you'll be right here with us all through the election. You can keep a close watch on him. If he shows any sign that his control's slipping, then you can report him. It's not as if he was that dangerous. There's no doubt he's a very powerful individual, but he couldn't hope to stand against the combined might of all the gods' sorcerers. I mean, those people take on rogue beings from the Street of Gods, and Mortis isn't exactly the high warlock now, is he? In the meantime, we need him. Adamant won't survive the election without Mortis's support.
All right. We'll see how it goes, but once the election is over...
Then we can talk about it again.
And if he turns dangerous?
Then you do what you have to do. I know my responsibilities, Captain.
Everyone looked at Danielle.
This isn't the first time you've worked with a magic user, is it, Captain Hawk? I seem to remember the sorcerer Gaunt was involved in the Blackstone case, wasn't he?
Only marginally. I never knew him very well. He left Haven shortly afterwards.
Damn shame, that. His loss was a great blow to the reform cause. Gaunt and Mortis were the only sorcerers of any note ever to ally themselves openly with the reformers.
Oh, you're better off without them. You can't trust magic or the people who use it.
Danielle raised a painted eyebrow.
You sound as though you've had some bad experiences with sorcery, Captain Hawk.
Hawk has a long memory, and he bears grudges.
How about you, Captain Fisher?
I don't get mad. I get even.
Right.
We haven't discussed your politics yet. What beliefs do you follow, if any? In my experience, guards tend to be uninterested in politics, apart from the usual favors and payoffs. Most of the time, they just support the status quo.
That's our job. We don't make the laws, we just enforce them, even the ones we don't agree with. Not all the guards in Haven are crooked. You've got to expect some bribery and corruption, that's how Haven works, but on the whole, the guard takes its job seriously. We have to. If we didn't, the council would replace us with someone who did. Too much corruption is bad for business, and the quality doesn't like its peace disturbed.
But what do you believe in, you and Captain Fisher?
My wife is basically disinterested in politics, right, Isabel?
Right.
Fisher held out her empty glass to Adamant for a refill.
Only thing more corrupt than a politician is a weak old corpse. No offense, Sir Adamant.
Oh, none taken.
As for me, Isabel and I come from the far north. We were both raised under absolute monarchies. Things were different there. It's taken us both some time to adjust to the changes democracy brought to Haven and the Low Kingdoms. I don't think we'll ever get used to the idea of a constitutional monarch.
On the whole, it seems to me that the same kind of people end up on top no matter what system you have. But at least in a democracy, there's room for change, which is why I tend to favor reform. The conservatives don't want any change because, for the most part, they're rich and privileged, and they want to stay that way. And they feel that the poor and the commoners should know their place. I've never known my place. But as far as this election is concerned, we're strictly neutral. It's our job to protect you, and we'll do that to the best of our ability. No one will bother you when we're around. Not openly, anyway. But don't waste time preaching to us. That's not what we're here for.
Of course. We quite understand. Still, you're being put to a great deal of trouble on our account. You'll become targets just by being associated with us. Under the circumstances, perhaps you would allow James and myself to show you our appreciation by providing you with a little extra money for expenses and the like. Shall we say 500 ducats each?
Medley reached inside his coat for his wallet and then froze as he took in Hawk's face. Medley looked from Hawk to Fisher and back again, and a sudden chill went through him. A subtle change had come over the two guards. There was a cold anger and violence in their faces, a violence barely held in check. For the first time, Medley realized how the two guards had earned their grim reputation, and he believed every word of it. He wanted to look to Adamant for support, but he couldn't tear his gaze away from the guards.
Are you offering us a bribe?
Not necessarily.
He could feel sweat beating on his forehead.
Get your hand away from that wallet or we'll do something unpleasant with it. You don't want to know what.
We don't take bribes. Ever. People trust us because they know we can't be bought by anyone.
My advisor meant no offense. He's just not used to dealing with honest people.
Politics does that to you.
And you have to admit, you are rather unusual, as Haven goes.
As Haven goes, we are unique.
You got that right.
Medley pulled at his coat to straighten it, though it didn't need straightening, and looked at the ornate brass-bound clock on the mantelpiece.
We're running late, James. The faithful will be arriving soon for your big speech.
Of course, Stefan.
Adamant got to his feet and smiled at Hawk and Fisher.
Come along, bodyguards. You should find this interesting.
Yes, quite interesting.
Hawk leaned morosely against the landing wall and wished half-heartedly for a riot. Adamant's followers filled the ballroom below, all of them cheerful and excited and buoyantly good-natured. They listened politely to Adamant's stewards and went where they were told without a murmur. Hawk couldn't believe it. Usually in Haven, you track down a political meeting by following the trail of broken bottles and mutilated corpses. Adamant's followers were enthusiastic as all hell, particularly about him, but seemed uninterested in the traditional pastimes of cursing the enemy and planning his destruction. They actually seemed more interested in discussing the issues. Hawk shook his head slowly, as if elections in Haven had anything to do with issues. He'd bet good money that Hardcastle's people weren't wasting time discussing the issues. More likely, they were busy planning death and bloodshed and general mayhem, and where best to make a start. Hawk glanced across at Fisher. She looked just as bored as he did. He looked back at the crowd. Maybe someone would faint in the crush. Anything for a little excitement. Hawk had reached the stage where he would have welcomed an outbreak of plague to relieve the tedium. He looked hopefully at Adamant, but the candidate seemed in no hurry to make his entrance. He sat quietly in his chair halfway down the landing, well out of sight of his followers. Thick velvet drapes had been hung the length of the landing, blocking off the view, just so that Adamant could make a dramatic entrance at the top of the stairs. The man seemed cold and perfectly relaxed, hands laced together in his lap, his eyes vague and far away. Medley, on the other hand, was stalking back and forth like a cat with piles, unable to settle anywhere for a moment. He clutched a thick sheaf of papers and shuffled them back and forth like the cards in a losing hand. Danielle glared at him irritably from time to time, but seemed mostly interested in studying her appearance in the full-length mirror on the wall. Down below, the crowd was getting noisy. They'd been patient a long time, and some of them looked a little tired of being good-natured about it. Hawk moved a little to one side so that he could see the mirror opposite him more clearly. It was the last in a series of mirrors, all cleverly arranged so that he could see down into the ballroom without being seen himself. One of Medley's better ideas. It wasn't a very big ballroom, as mentioned ballrooms went, but the packed crowd made it seem larger. Massed lamps and candles supplied a blaze of light, though the air was starting to get a little thick. Portraits of stern-faced ancestors from the original owner's family lined the walls, all of them looking highly respectable. Hawk's mouth twitched. If they'd still been alive, they'd have probably had coronaries at what their house was being used for. Adamant supporters filled the ballroom from one end to the other, latecomers pushed tight against the closed doors, while the front of the crowd spilled over onto the first few steps of the stairs to the second story. They seemed to blend together into a mass of shiny faces and eager eyes. A handful of stewards stopped them from getting any further up the stairs. A few more stewards moved slowly through the crowd, keeping an eye out for unfamiliar faces and paid saboteurs. They looked very alone and very vulnerable in the crowd. Everyone there was supposed to be Adamant's friend, but Hawk didn't trust any crowd that large. They'd been well-behaved so far, but Hawk had seen enough crowds in his time to know that they could turn ugly in a moment. Should things get out of hand, there was precious little Adamant's men would be able to do to restrain such a mob. They weren't even wearing swords.
Takes more to handle a crowd than good intentions.
Hawk looked around as Adamant stirred in his chair, but the candidate was just shifting his weight more comfortably. He still looked cool and calm and utterly at ease. He could have been waiting for his second cup of tea at breakfast instead of his first real test of popularity and support. At first, Hawk thought it was all just a pose, a mask to hide his nervousness behind, but there was none of the overstillness that betrayed inner tension. Hawk shot a glance at Fisher, who nodded slightly to show she'd noticed it too. Adamant might be new to politics, but it seemed he already knew the first rule. Politicians inspire fervor, but they don't fall prey to it themselves. Or, to put it another way, Adamant was professional enough to be a cold-hearted son of a bitch when he had to be. A point worth remembering. Medley, on the other hand, looked as though he might explode at any moment. His face was covered with a sheen of sweat and his hands were shaking. His hair was a mess and he ran his fingers through it like a comb when he thought no one was looking. He kept glancing at the crowd's image in the mirror as they grew increasingly noisy, and his silent monologue became even more urgent as he ran through a list of things Adamant absolutely had to remember once he got out there in front of the crowd. Medley brushed near Danielle and she shot him another dark look before going back to fussing over her appearance. The young wife's dress was stylish, her makeup immaculate, but she couldn't seem to assure herself of that without constant checking. Hawk smiled. Everyone had their own way of dealing with nerves. For the most part, he dealt with them by keeping busy. Hawk studied the scene in the mirror again and stirred uneasily. The crowd was definitely getting restive. The thin line of stewards at the foot of the stairs looked thinner than ever. Hawk smiled briefly. It was one thing to wish for a little action to relieve the boredom, but quite another when it came to actually having to deal with it. Medley shuffled too near Danielle, one time too many.
Stefan, be still.
They locked gazes for a moment, and then Danielle turned to Adamant for support. He smiled at both of them and got out of his chair. He traded a few quiet, reassuring words with each, touching just long enough for some of his calm to rub off on them. Adamant smiled at Hawk and Fisher.
There's an art to this, you know. The longer we make them wait, the greater their response will be when I finally appear. Of course, let it go on too long and they'll riot. It's all in the timing.
He strode purposefully out onto the top of the stairs. They waved their banners, releasing their pent-up emotions in a single great roar of love and acclaim. Adamant smiled and waved. And Danielle and Medley moved out onto the top of the stairs to join him. Danielle smiled graciously at the crowd. Medley nodded briskly, his face gray and impassive. Back in the hidden part of the landing, Hawk's gaze darted across the viewing mirror, checking the crowd for trouble spots. Letting this much raw emotion loose in a confined space was a calculated risk. All it needed was one unfortunate incident and the whole thing could turn very nasty. The trick, according to Medley, was to concentrate all the emotion on Adamant through a combination of speeches and theatrics, and then turn the people loose on the city while they were still boiling over with enthusiasm. A good trick if you can pull it off. Adamant probably could. He was good with words. The right words at the right time can topple thrones and build empires, or bring on rebellions and civil wars and dead men lying in burning fields. Fisher stirred uneasily at Hawk's side, picking up some of his tension, and he made himself relax a little. Nothing was going to happen. Adamant and Medley had everything planned right down to the last detail. Hardcastle's people wouldn't interfere. They might not know about Mortis himself, but they had to know some magic user was looking out for Adamant. Hawk looked across at Adamant. The candidate continued to smile and wave, milking the moment for all it was worth. Danielle stood serenely at his side, doing her best to be openly supportive without drawing any attention away from her husband. Medley looked uncomfortable in the spotlight, but no one expected him to be charismatic. It was enough that he was there, openly allied with Adamant. Hawk looked back at the crowd in the mirror, which still showed no signs of cooling down. They all carried flags or banners or placards, and they all wore the blue ribbon of the reform cause. They were a mixture of types and classes with no obvious connections. There were a large number of poorly dressed, hard-worn characters whose reasons for supporting reform seemed clear. But the crowd included others whose clothes and bearing marked them clearly as tradesmen and merchants, even some members of the quality. Usually, the only place you'd find such a combination gathered peacefully together was in the city morgue, or the debtor's prison. Yet here they were, standing happily shoulder to shoulder, united in friendship and purpose by the man they trusted and cheered. Politics made for strange bedfellows. Adamant lifted his hands. The cheering was replaced by an expectant hush. Hawk watched closely from the shadows of the landing. There was something different about Adamant now, something powerful. He seemed to have grown in stature and authority, as though the crowd's belief in him made him the hero they needed him to be. The man Hawk met earlier seemed pleasant enough, even charming. But this new Adamant harbored a power and charisma that set him ablaze like a beacon in the night. His presence filled the ballroom. For the first time, Hawk understood why Hardcastle was afraid of this man. All eyes were fixed on Adamant now in the silent room. There was a hungry, determined feel to the silence that Hawk didn't like. It occurred to him that the relationship between Adamant and his followers wasn't just a one-way street. These people worshipped him. They might even die for him. But in a way, they owned him, too. They defined what he was and what he might be. Adamant's speech lasted the better part of an hour, and the crowd lapped it up. He talked about the dark side of Haven, the sweatshops and the work gangs, the company shops that made sure their employees stayed poor, and the company bullies who dealt with anyone who dared speak out. He talked about rotten food and foul drinking water, about houses with holes in the roof and rats in the walls. And the crowd reacted with shock and outrage as though they'd never known such things existed. Adamant made them see their world with fresh eyes and see how bad it really was. He told them about the powerful and privileged men who cared nothing for the poor because they were born into the wrong class and therefore were nothing more than animals to be used and discarded as their betters saw fit. He told them of the titled men and women who gorged themselves on six-course meals in gorgeous banquet halls while the children of the poor died in the streets from hunger and exposure. And the raw hatred from the crowd was a palpable presence in the ballroom. And then, he told them, things didn't have to be that way anymore. He exalted the cause of reform and how the evils of Haven would finally be done away with, not by violence and revolution, but by slow, continued change. By people working together instead of against each other, regardless of class or wealth or position.
Our work will not be easy. There are those in Haven who would fight and die rather than see the system change. Reform will be a long fight and a hard fight, but in the end, reform will win. Because working together, all of us, we people, we are stronger by far than the privileged individuals who seek to keep us in our place, keep us in the gutter.
Adamant smiled proudly down at the men and women before him and again quieted the crowd.
Let others call us troublemakers and anarchists. We will show the people of Haven the truth. We are just men and women who have had enough, and we'll see justice done, whatever it takes. They can't kill us all.
Adamant had taken a crowd of individuals and forged them into an army, and they knew it. All they needed now was an enemy to fight, and they'd find that soon enough out on the streets. Hawk watched the crowd in the mirror, impressed but deeply disturbed. Raising violent emotions like these was dangerous for everyone involved. If Hardcastle could raise similar feelings in his followers, there would be blood and death in the streets when the two sides met. Adamant raised his hands again, and the crowd grew still. He paused a moment, as though searching for just the right words.
Violence is Hardcastle's way, not ours. Let the voters see who resorts to violence first. They will see who speaks the truth and who dares not let it be heard.
Adamant looked out over his people. It was inevitable that people were going to be hurt in the hours ahead, maybe even killed.
Whatever happens, we must only ever fight to defend ourselves, and then only as much as needed. It is easy to fall into the trap of hatred and revenge, but that is the enemy's way, not ours. Reform fights to change, not destroy.
He paused again to let the thought sink in.
Now, my friends, let us wage hope. Let us spread light. Let us embrace our destiny, for we are the beacon of tomorrow!
Adamant strode unhurriedly off into the shadows of the landing, followed by Danielle and Medley. His audience cheered him till their throats were raw, and then filed slowly out of the ballroom, laughing and chattering excitedly about the day ahead. Back in the concealing shadows of the landing, Adamant sank wearily into his chair.
I think that went rather well.
He put out a hand to Danielle, and she took it firmly in both of hers.
It should have. We spent long enough rehearsing it.
Oh, never mind him. You are wonderful, darling. Listen to them, James. They're still cheering you.
It's a hard life being a politician. All this power and adulation. How will I ever stand the pressure?
Wait till we get out in the streets, James. That's when the real work starts. They do things differently out there.